Ready? Are we on? Okay, I'll now open the public hearing for comments on proposed rules in case number PU-17-23. Does anyone wish to testify on case PU-17-23 relating to wind farm decommissioning requirements? And Mr. Lean will be there here in a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Jerry Lynn, and I'm an analyst with the Public Service Commission. And the purpose of my testimony here is to explain and provide support for changes proposed to the Commission's administrative rules regarding wind turbine decommissioning in Chapter 690909 of the North Dakota Administrative Code. I did have some copies of my testimony out on the table over there. And there was one correction to that, and that is on page 2 at the top in line 2. It says, for existing facilities cited before July 1st, 2017, that's changed to read for existing facilities constructed before July 1st, 2017.
Mr. Lean, I believe it's page 3, line 2.
Yes, it is page 3. My footer is also wrong. It didn't do the auto change on the page numbers. So,
okay, we'll note that correction.
Thank you. So back to the testimony. The commission initially proposed decommissioning rules in 2007, and they became effective on October 1st of 2008. Over the last 8 to 9 years, the state has seen a substantial number of commercial wind energy conversion facilities begin operation. As wind generation continues to expand and sheer numbers across the state and installations grow in size and scale, the costs and consequences of failed or improper decommissioning have grown to be a cause of concern. The proposed rules are intended to strengthen the method of ensuring that funds will be available for decommissioning and restoration throughout the life of the project. They heighten decommissioning requirements for future wind energy facilities and allow the commission to more effectively monitor the methods and costs for decommissioning and restoration. The proposed changes to the definitions under 6909-0901 reflect the proposed changes in the subsequent sections under Chapter 690909. The proposed changes to Section 690902 clarify that the owner of the site certification is responsible for the decommissioning. The proposed rules in Section 3 require the owners of the project to file annual certifications demonstrating the operation of the facility during the previous year. Subject to rebuttal, a proposed project would be presumed to be at the end of its useful life if the capacity factor is less than 10% and abandoned if after commencement and prior to completion of construction, a period of 24 months has passed with no construction. The 10% was chosen as a conservative minimum capacity factor, considering that a modern North Dakota wind project normally operates in a range of around 50% capacity factor. The idea being there that if you get below the 10% level, there's probably something wrong, but it is rebuttable. Absent commission approval of a plan to return the facility to operation, the proposed change in section 6909-0904 increases the decommissioning period allowed to complete decommissioning from 18 to 24 months. The purpose of these changes in sections 03 and 04 are to better define and recognize when decommissioning is required and to allow a longer decommissioning period in recognition that longer winters can sometimes hinder decommissioning. Section 6909-0905 is proposed to be amended to increase the foundation building and ancillary equipment removal depths required for new facilities from 3 feet to 4 feet. A review of decommissioning requirement of states, counties, and site permits indicates that removal of facilities are often required to a depth of 4 feet. The purpose is to provide further protection against possible conflicts with future surface usage. Removal of foundations, buildings, and ancillary equipment for existing facilities constructed before July 1st, 2017 will not be affected. Language is added to require commission approval of an owner request to allow landowners to retain surface features such as roads, etc. The purpose is to guard against possible short-term cash windfalls at the expense of long-term productivity of the property. Proposed changes to section 6909-0906 require decommissioning plans with cost estimates to be filed for the commission approval prior to construction, whereas the existing rule requires decommissioning plans to be filed for commission review prior to operation. The commission would have up to 6 months to make a determination on the decommissioning plan. This mirrors the time period for designating a site or corridor under North Dakota Century Code Section 49-2208, and while not required, it is anticipated that applicants will make the filings at the same time to have the time periods run concurrently. With the proposed changes, decommissioning cost estimates would need to be made by a professional engineer and may include salvage value in addition to an estimate excluding salvage value. Cost estimates must be updated 10 years after initial approval and then every 5 years after that until fully decommissioned. These changes are intended to accommodate the proposed requirement for decommissioning financial assurance to be in place prior to construction. Under existing rules, the commission may require financial assurance for decommissioning after 10 years of operation. Proposed changes to Section 6909-0907 require a facility with a certificate of site compatibility issued prior to July 1, 2017 to provide financial assurance after the 10th year of operation. The proposed changes to Section 6909-08 require financial assurance for facilities cited under July 1st, 2017 to be provided prior to construction. Changes to Section 6909-08 clarify and heighten the financial assurance requirements and allow the Commission to require additional financial assurance upon a finding that current financial assurance for a facility is insufficient. The proposed changes allow financial assurance to be in the form of an incremental bond schedule after an initial bond increment prior to construction. Minimum bond ratings for self or parent guarantees are to be considered. Is proposed to be increased to A, as issued by Moody's Investor Service, Standards and Poor's, or an equivalent rating organization. Language is added to restrict total outstanding self-guarantees to 25% of the owner's net worth in the U.S. and to allow the commission to accept a self or parent guarantee from the electric utilities it regulates. These self-bonding limitations would mirror those of the Office of Surface Mining for Coal Reclamation. The purpose of these proposed changes is to ensure that only the most sound owners are allowed to self-guarantee. And this concludes my testimony. I would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
I should have told you of this question coming probably so you could check your paperwork. So you can just the estimate is fine. Do you recall in 2007 when the legislature had passed the law for the commission to be able to adopt the rules and the commission undertook the project in 2007 about how many megawatts of wind, commercial wind generation were online in North Dakota at the time?
I could only kind of estimate a guess. And I'd say at that time we probably had a 1,000 megawatts or less.
And do you recall once Lindahl goes online here in a couple of weeks, how many megawatts will have come online just from last May until a few weeks from now?
Probably in the last year or so, we've had about 1,000 megawatts come on.
So. And then I know one thing that I've heard some concern about regarding this rule package, and you addressed it, but I just want to clarify, as far as that rule change that would identify when a farm is no longer in service at operating at 10% capacity or less for a year. That is subject to a rebuttal if they're having some kinds of difficulties with a contract or with getting some service or something like that. That's built into the rule that there's an opportunity to get commission approval to overturn that. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely.
I don't have any other questions, Mr. Shu. Okay. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Other testimony on PU-17-23. And wherever you're more comfortable, it's fine.
Probably behind the podium.
Okay.
Commissioner, so for the record, Commissioner Chrisman, my name is Jean Schaefer. I'm with Basin Electric. And Basin Electric just has two minor revisions that we would like to see to the rule as proposed, dealing with sections 04, as Mr. Lean just had talked about. That is listed at 8 months. And our distributed generation had taken a look at that and was asking that if there would be a delay, certainly for weather concerns, as was already identified, could that be extended instead of 8 to 12 months to allow for any weather concerns, a bad winter, I think, which is top of mind for everybody at this point, wet spring, wet fall, any types of situations. And on my written testimony, I have the red line versions of what we would be taking a look at for your consideration, as you could see as written. The second revision would be in the section 09, and that would have to do with the bonding rating category. And it's really just to allow for the instance if you would have an A-minus rating. We wanted to see if we could have that wording changed to in the current rating in the A category. That could then allow the an A minus rating that would come from any one of these rating agencies, and also then in the event of a split rating, if there could be a sentence added at the bottom of that, that if an organization has different ratings among the various rating organizations, the commission shall accept the higher of the two. So just those two minor changes would be what we would be asking for consideration, and I would be happy to stand for any questions, Commissioner.
It would seem to me the fact that on the second one, mm-hmm. as far as the various rating agencies, and I guess I need to think about that language some, as far as is an A minus an A or is it not an A? I'll contemplate that. But
sure.
As far as one or the other agencies, I guess it kind of seems to me when it lists Moody's, Standard & Poor's, or an equivalent agency, I guess that's kind of what I was thinking of.
That
would
latitude.
Be the case,
sure.
Yes.
So. Sure. I think it was more of a, when we take a look at it up in the on the finance division, the devil's in the details type of situation. So they just wanted to make sure that if they could have that coverage, that would certainly be acceptable to Basin.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
No questions, Commissioner.
Okay. Nor do I. Thank you, Gene. Now hurry before someone behind you starts.
Morning, Commissioner. My name is Frank Costanza. I'm with Tradewind Energy, a developer of renewable energy projects. We are the
Frank,
developer of the
Lindahl. So spell your name, please, before you...
Sure. Costanza.
Thank you.
As I said, I represent Tradewind Energy. I'm an executive vice president with the company and have been with them since 2005. We are one of the largest privately held developers of renewable energy projects in the country, having developed and in operation over 2,000 megawatts of wind and several hundred megawatts of solar projects throughout the central portion of the United States. We are also financially partnered with Enel Green Power North America, and we have successfully executing the Lindahl project here in North Dakota, which will come into operation here in another month. My testimony actually covers both of the cases here. I just wanted to note that for the record. I will not read the testimony today that I've provided. Rather, I'd just like to touch on a couple things related to the case we're now speaking about. Really, there's just we've filed suggested wording changes to the rules, and we've offered some very detailed commentary to support those notions. Two things that we'd like to talk about today are simply one is the 10% capacity factor requirement that would constitute a need for decommissioning. We feel the number clearly is arbitrary. Noted that today's wind power projects can produce wind about 50% of the time. That's not in dispute. However, we think that it is an arbitrary number, and there are a couple factors that could detrimentally affect a wind project. One is simply market conditions. We're part of the SPP power pool. They have recently in the last couple of years, adopted new market protocols for dispatching all forms of generation, including wind. Those market protocols are continuing to change, and over the 20 or 30-year life of a wind project, and particularly over the period of a long-term power purchase agreement, those rules may and will change, likely, to accommodate future conditions. So we can and would suggest that there's a potential for rule changes that might preclude a wind project from operating at a given arbitrary capacity factor level. Second one, and more importantly, is catastrophic conditions or failure of equipment. For example, the main step-up transformer that all the energy from a power project goes through to get into the grid, a failure of that transformer could put a project out of service for easily a year. And I say that because we've lived through that in our company. Our Smoky Hills project in Kansas had a failure of that very piece of equipment and was out of service slightly over a year because of the long lead time to order, place the order, have the equipment manufactured, delivered, installed, and tested. So, again, there are reasons, and we realize that there is a provision for rebuttal before the commission, but over, again, a long 20, 30-year time frame, we would like to suggest that the current rule, which says failure to operate for a continuous 24 months, is a more common practice, not in most states where we operate. And we'd like to suggest that be reconsidered as the threshold for defining when a project needs to be decommissioned. My second comment is with regard to Section 6909, 0906, and 090908 combined. This has to do with the filing of the decommissioning plan, the timing of that, as well as the placement of security. A couple thoughts we'd like to offer and have provided in our filing is the notion that the decommissioning plan, I think, is contemplated right now in the rules, would be filed sometime coincident with the site compatibility permit process. That process has to occur substantially earlier than when we have our final site plan, site design in place. Decommissioning and the use of and we don't dispute the need for would accept the need for having a licensed engineer perform the study that says the decommissioning costs are X. But that plan has to be based on what you're finally going to build. And we literally in the wind business don't know that until a few months before we start construction. We're constantly moving turbines, which moves roads, which moves wire. And so we would propose that we look at this in a bifurcated way, that the site plan and permitting go ahead as traditionally has been done, but that we submit the decommissioning plan after construction has started and when we know what we're building. The reason for that is we're also concerned about the notion, at least that's been proposed, that the commission would have 6 months to reply to the plan. Well, during construction, we know exactly what we're building. The decommissioning plan can reflect that, and the costs will be known, and we can move forward. So we'd suggest that the plan be submitted after construction starts when we know what we're building. The second is regarding security. We'd like to offer the notion and have offered the notion that we bifurcate this into two pieces of security. One, we understand that there is a concern by the commission and landowners that today some projects may be started before a power purchase agreement is secured. They may be digging holes, and then if the project doesn't come together, there's no plan in place to decommission the project. We'd like to suggest to cover that type of a situation that there be a bond or security in place at the start of construction that covers and equal to about 10% of the 10% of the construction cost. We base that number, and we've provided an explanation in our comments that have been filed with the commission for that number. It has to do with it equates roughly to the cost of decommissioning a full project. After construction is complete, that security would be released, and then we would file for and put in place another security element that would cover the true decommissioning based on the decommissioning plan that was submitted and approved by the PSC. We would like to propose, because these are long-lived projects, that security increase over time. In our In our filing, we've suggested that 25% of the decommissioning cost be placed at the start of commercial operation, second 25% be placed at year five, and then finally the full decommissioning security be placed at year 10. And then we agree that updating the decommissioning plan every 5 years thereafter and adjusting the security based on that would certainly be acceptable. Those are our brief comments on those issues. I'm ready to answer any questions you may have.
So you said you have a separate written testimony that you're turning in. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. I've given that testimony for today, this morning, and also we've submitted our detailed comments on the rules and the explanation for the changes we seek.
Okay. Regarding the give me a chance to flip back here through to get to the right rule package here. The 10% capacity factor to identify end of useful life. In the current situation where it's based on not being operational, when a company could be potentially faced with many millions of dollars in decommissioning costs, isn't there a likelihood of just always having a plan to get it started again? And I mean, I get the point that there can be situations where the catastrophic event occurs or the market situation occurs, and thus we have the potential for a rebuttal. But without a clear line of some level of production there, will there ever be an end to the plan to always get this going at some point in the future, as opposed to actually investing significant amounts of money to actually decommission and reclaim a property?
Sure. I understand the concern, and I would suggest for consideration that these projects, utility-scale wind projects, the type that we build, usually 100 megawatts or more at a time, these are multi-hundred-million-dollar projects. The way we finance these projects is called project finance. We basically, about 50% of the money for the project comes from third-party financiers, 50% comes from the owner. The way that we structure the repayment of the financier's money is that it is all front-end loaded. So the money that we're making via our power purchase agreement, the revenue stream that comes in, is sufficient to pay the debt, call it the debt service, if you will, to repay the financiers, to pay for the operations, and then a small, very small amount of cash flow goes to the owner. So the owner is getting just a very slight amount of the cash. He operates the plant, and at year 10, roughly, there's a flip in the cash flows. The financier has been paid off, and now the owner starts to receive the free cash flow, which is the return of capital and return on capital. So both the financier and the owner are incented to keep these projects working long term. So it would only be in the case of these severe situations where we do have some catastrophic event or market conditions where we simply can't operate, but we still want to make our money and we still want to get our return. So I think that the chances of walking away, to our knowledge, and we've done some research with the major financiers in the market, some of the law firms that represent both financiers and owners. To our knowledge, there hasn't been a utility-scale project, that's gone bankrupt and abandoned a wind facility that we know of. certainly not in the modern era, which started in of wind, which started in about 2000, late 1990s.
Mr. Hsu? Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning.
My name is Chris Kunkel. I'm a regional policy manager with Wind on the Wires. Wind on the Wires is a regional group that works on the policy, regulatory, and technical issues affecting the clean energy sector. Our members include private wind and solar developers, turbine manufacturers, construction companies, other businesses that supply goods and services to the industry. So in that sense, we're a sort of trade association for the industry throughout the Midwest. We filed comments online, and I'm not going to read through them verbatim, but we're certainly hopeful that our regional perspective will be helpful as the commission considers changes to the decommissioning rules. So starting there, I want to applaud the commission for taking this look at the decommissioning rules. I think this process will be very helpful to hopefully addressing the very real concerns of landowners and host communities. And I think I'm hopeful, again, that having that statewide look will serve, will provide a bit of stability for industry. A lot of other states, there's much more of a patchwork of decommissioning requirements, which can be a little bit more difficult. But I'd also note that balance is critical, and maintaining the state's competitive edge is critical. There's a reason why there is so much development occurring in North Dakota. I think there's a few different reasons for that. And a big piece of it is, I think, the state's reputation as an energy powerhouse for the region. I think going forward, we can continue to maintain that reputation. But keeping the rules of the road stable and competitive with neighboring states is critical in that. And so I think as the commission is considering changes to these rules, recognizing the realities of the market in this regard is very important. I think as Mr. Costanza mentioned, being from a regional group, we have a number of states that started building wind in the mid-90s. We are seeing absolutely no indications. There's no instances in our footprint that we're aware of a wind farm actually going towards decommissioning. What we're seeing quite often at this point is a trend towards repowering of these aging assets. Even though they're, you know, 25 or 30 years of life on these projects, at year 10 or 15, because of the way turbines have evolved and improved, we're starting to see a major push towards reinvesting in those assets to ensure that there is continued operation and uninterrupted operation. And I think the demand for renewables seems to be growing rather than waning, whether that's as a driver of state policy or just because customers, whether it's residential or CNI customers, are demanding that. So we think that there will continue to be a demand from customers for this electricity. And so I think that as the commission considers potential rule changes, keeping those market trends in mind is going to be very important. I'd also note...
Hey, Randy, excuse me really quickly. This is Julie. I just wanted to make note that I'm on the call now and listening in, and apologize for not being able to be there in person. But if you could also just bring me up to speed as far as who's testifying right now, that would be helpful so I can have that context as I listen.
Right now we have Chris Kunkel from Wind on the Wires. And we've already finished the testimony on the first case on the lighting systems and are on the decommissioning one. However, some people's testimony covers both of them, and we made it clear at the beginning that that was fine. So it's sort of a mixture of the two, I guess, a little bit. But it's Mr. Kunkel testifying right now.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And again, I apologize for being late and being absent, but I'm gonna listen and participate as long as I can.
No apologies necessary. Life happens.
Yeah, thanks. And sorry, Chris. You feel free to proceed now.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, as I was saying, as we're thinking about these rule changes, the market for wind right now is hyper competitive. Companies are trying to deliver a product at the absolute lowest cost possible. XL Energy recently went through a request for proposal for wind power. They were looking for about 1,500 megawatts of wind. They got about 10,000 megawatts back in response. And so that's, I think, an indicator of the opportunity that is there and the reality that in order to win those bids, companies are trying to, again, reduce their costs, drive that cost down, and be able to deliver a product that is the lowest cost possible to customers. And so states companies, when they're deciding what state to invest in, where to build projects, they look at the entirety, I think, of the state's regulations, policies, et cetera. And so maintaining that competitiveness for North Dakota is going to be, in my mind, critical to ensuring that the state does maintain that reputation as a powerhouse for the region and does not risk losing investment to Minnesota or South Dakota. And so because I do think that there's a couple provisions, and again, I'm not going to walk through a testimony, but that would move North Dakota a little bit out of step with neighboring states on a couple of the provisions. And again, I want to underscore that I think we're absolutely moving in the right direction here. I'm, again, hopeful that our comments, that the comments from a couple of companies are helpful in providing that, helping us strike that balance. Because I absolutely agree with the previous testifier, there is a middle ground here. There's a balance that I think we can find.
Chris, achieving... What are the provisions you think that go too far? And I'd rather have you available for questioning on that rather than seeing it later and not being able to ask any follow-up questions. So I'm not saying go into detail about that, but if you could kind of at a high level get, you know, what are the provisions that are most troublesome?
Yeah,
put us out of balance with other states.
Yeah, thank you. So I think Mr. Costanza before me touched on a couple of these points. The timing is critical for wind right now, and we want to make sure first, I guess, that as the commission considers the decommissioning plan, that it is that it's in line with the site compatibility permit. Again, to Mr. Costanza's point, there's a concern that either a project, by requiring this plan before construction, there's a concern of either a delay on that, or there's a concern of it's very difficult to reasonably estimate all of the specifics about a project on which the decommissioning plan is based. So the specifics of turbine location and turbine model and all these different elements that affect the cost of decommissioning, those are not necessarily known until right before construction actually begins. And so I'm not saying a decommissioning plan is a bad idea by any means. I think it's smart. But I think making sure that these are lined up, and I think that's probably the intent of the commission, but making sure these are lined up is going to be critical, again, just to figure out that balance.
But isn't that
with how
what
these,
we're doing? I thought that's what we're doing with our rules, is lining them up
so
that they're due at the same time. So you must want them at different times.
So I think the concern is by requiring it at the beginning of I don't have it in front of me, of course. I believe that it is required at the that it has to be approved in its entirety, the decommissioning plan, before any construction begins, I believe.
Correct.
And so to line it up, you'd like it when?
So I think tying it to operation seems to make a little bit more sense, just because that, first of all, that's, I think, how other states look at this, but also it allows for the specifics of the project, again, which are not known 6 months prior to construction, it allows those to be more known. Therefore, the decommissioning plan itself can be more accurate.
So in most of our recent cases, Chris, we've had a company come in with the application, and they might have two potential turbine options, or three, or I don't know, maybe even four. And if it's a larger megawatt turbine that is the ultimate choice, then there might be fewer turbines built, but they have those built in. Wouldn't it just be logical then that the company would sit down with a professional engineer that works with these kinds of things and look at these? And just like when they do that, part of that process is that they have to show the potential decibels of sound reaching neighboring residences and businesses, as well as shadow flicker. And we always get a worst-case scenario. This residence could get this many hours of shadow flicker if, and it shows whichever of the turbine options is the worst for that resident. Wouldn't the company just do the same thing and say the worst-case decommissioning cost is X number of dollars and have it at the same time, and it would be pretty simple?
That certainly seems reasonable. I defer to what the companies. I'm sure different companies would handle that sort of thing a little bit differently, and I don't want to speak for one project or one company. But hearing the intent of the commission, which is to say that we are shooting for streamlining, and we are shooting for making sure that this new requirement would fit well within the existing permits and things like that's very helpful for me to hear. Again, I'd refer back to the couple comments that we made on this provision. But that's, I think, kind of what we're trying to do is keep things in line, I think, with neighboring states to a degree, and what we've seen elsewhere is it being tied to operation. So
as a quick follow-up on that, mm-hmm. if you're tying it to construction and not or operation, not construction, what happens to a project that starts construction and is never completed? And how do we – that's why we want to start it at construction and not operation, because we're trying to prevent any gaps and any stranded investments out there that don't have any sort of a – you know, reclamation plan or proceeds in place to cover that. What does the industry say to, you know, to that concern of ours?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think under the financial assurance section in our comments, and Mr. Costanza mentioned this as well, a company could post, for example, some portion of the financial assurance at the start of construction to accommodate for exactly this concern. Then you know, getting to this phased-in approach where then at operation you would post an increased amount, and then at year whatever you'd post the full mm-hmm. amount. Because that, I think, recognizes the exact circumstance that you're mentioning, Commissioner, which is if a project starts construction and then is unable to sign a PPA or something like that, the cost to actually decommission that segment or small amount of a project is not – it's much, much, much less than the cost to decommission an entire project.
Right.
So having that phased-in approach is very important from our perspective.
And so the same being on a decommissioning plan. you had a phase-in approach for the bond and the financial assurances, but the full plan wouldn't be required in your optimal situation until, or optimal end game until operation?
Well, yeah, I think just allowing that flexibility is going to be very important, whether it's, you know, perhaps it's just some sort of conditional approval, or I'm kind of spitballing here, but some sort of conditional approval at the start of construction, and then allowing a company to come in with the specifics of their project, for example, at the time of once construction, or at the time of full operation. So that flexibility, I think, from an industry perspective, is going to be important.
Okay, good. Were there any other major concerns that you had that you have included in your comments but weren't going to address specifically?
Yeah, so I kind of got into the financial assurance piece there. Again, just allowing that phased-in approach. And the other thing I'd mention there is we want to, as I understand it, local units of government can impose bond requirements, that sort of thing as well. I want to make sure that the commission is considering those local bonding requirements as well, and so that there's no, you know, double counting of these sorts of bonds.
Okay.
Just a couple of other things I'll just real quickly touch on. I concur with Mr. Costanza around this 10% issue for the capacity factor. Recognize that there is that rebuttal provision in there. I think that it's still a little bit concerning. Maintaining the, and I'm kind of jumping around here, and I apologize for that. Ensuring that salvage value can be considered, I think, is also important. I think there's, I'd have to look back at the actual rule, but there's one place in the rule where they're allowed to, the commission may consider salvage value, and there's another place where specifically it says must exclude salvage value. And so I think aligning those two is important.
Well, I think the rule, as you read it through the whole thing, to me seems fairly clear that it allows the commission to consider salvage value if the company asked for it, and the commission would choose to do that. However, it requires a decommissioning plan be proposed that excludes it, so the commission can at least consider that too.
Okay.
Otherwise, I very much doubt that the companies will submit one without the salvage value already figured in.
Okay. Quickly on, probably should have mentioned at the start, our comments do refer to both of the cases before you or the rulemaking dockets. And so just quickly on the lighting piece, and we heard this from Mr. Shepard, maintaining the flexibility there to allow for additional technologies that result in the same end goal. Whether it's this new LIDS technology or there's certainly other ones on the market, I think that's important as well. There's only a couple of companies, as I understand it, that are actually delivering these aircraft lighting detection systems or have received FAA approval. And so I think if there's different ways to get that same result, which is to reduce this lighting pollution for rural parts of the state, I think we should allow for different types of technology if they have met FAA approval to get there.
And Chris, I'm just going to interrupt here for a second. Commissioner Fedorchak, early on in the first hearing, we heard from Mr. Shepard from Drake Lighting Company about their, they call it LIDS, the Light Intensity Dimming Solution, as an option. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Chris is talking about here. And so if you have questions specifically regarding that, we've talked about it earlier, and now that Chris brought it up at this point, I thought it was a good time to just point that out to you.
Yeah, good. I have heard generally about that technology, and I agree that it's important to provide flexibility and not tie our rules to specific named technology, but the goal, which is to reduce the visual impact of the lighting system. So I think that's a good suggestion. And I hear a lot of concern about the manufacturers and the availability of their aircraft detection lighting system. And I guess I have faith that when there's a huge demand for something, others step forward. So I don't want to back off on, requiring this type of technology just because there might be a concern about its availability. If it gets to the point where there is a concern about the availability and people can't get it to use it by the timelines, then we'll deal with that. But, supply and demand works pretty darn good. And I have confidence in that system to step up when there's a huge demand for something.
And one other thing on this section that I wanted to put on your radar, no pun intended, is as I understand it, and I'm by no means an FAA expert. Maybe Mr. Shepard can speak to this perhaps. As I understand it, though, the FAA approval process can be somewhat fluid up until construction in terms of them actually approving the specifics of your lighting mitigation system, and in some instances can even be modified through the early stages of construction. So I want to make sure that there's, again, some flexibility here in the phrase FAA approved or if there's perhaps some sort of conditional permit that FAA provides. What I'd be concerned about is if the FAA suggests some sort of modification to what was initially proposed or denies something, that it would not terminate or invalidate the entirety of a permit from the state of North Dakota. Again, I clearly need to do a little bit more research on that point, but I've heard concerns from industry about how fluid that process can be from FAA, and so having a hard and fast rule from the state can be concerning.
Well, I think that's why we have it, recognizing that the FAA plays a role there, and all these lighting sure. plans have to be approved by the FAA, that we don't intend to override by our rule what the FAA determines to be safe. So I think, Randy, we're in pretty strong agreement on that, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's basically it for my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you about this and voice our suggestions. I just want to, again, applaud the commission for taking such a robust look at this very important element of wind development, I guess.
I have a couple questions, but Julie, I'll defer to you if you are having any time constraints.
Oh, you go ahead, Randy. I'm good okay. right now. Thanks.
I don't mean to be picking on you, Chris, but you're the generic guy, and otherwise, if I ask these specific companies, it might seem like, well, I'm picking on sure. that one as opposed to the other one or something.
I will do my best.
You talked about the state's reputation as an energy powerhouse and keeping in line with other neighboring states. So you feel we're doing all right on that to this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the state's all of the above approach to energy, the state's streamlined regulatory approach, I think those are the reasons why you see, not to mention the fantastic wind resource here, that's the reason why you've seen so much development in the last few years.
And how many wind farms or megawatts of potential generation are under construction or have come online in South Dakota in the last year?
None, to my knowledge. There's a bunch of projects being planned for in the state right now. The big issue in South Dakota was a lack of transmission access, as well as some difficult tax policies down there that were cleaned up a couple years ago. And with the CapEx transmission lines, we're starting to see an incredible amount of demand in eastern South Dakota. And in fact, if you look at, this is just only one metric for this, but if you look at the MISO interconnection queue for wind, there's, I think, three or four counties in South Dakota that are growing faster than almost any other county in terms of, prospecting for wind than anywhere else in the region.
But as far as approved and under construction or coming online in the last year when we've added 1,000 megawatts yeah. And have approved much more than that, they're at zero.
I'm not aware of any, and maybe some other companies can jump in there. But, yeah, I think with that, the lack of transmission access in the state and that unstable tax policy, it really slowed things down there.
And then do you think, I know, unlike me, it gets to be before your time, but do you think back about 45 years ago or so when North Dakota imposed reclamation requirements on the coal mining companies, that there was equal concern for our competitive nature with other states and becoming too restrictive and that sort of thing?
That's a good question. I don't have a great answer for you there. I'm not as familiar with that process or the history there.
I assure you there was plenty, and the state moved forward and did that before the federal government did, and I think it's been an important part of our history. And then when we do cite these cases, are you familiar with how on some things like eagle issues and wetlands issues, we defer a lot of things to federal sure. requirements?
And for better or worse.
But in general, that seems to be helpful to the companies to have one set of guidelines to have to go by. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes. In short, yes.
And I have to check one thing in your written
sure.
comments here. Yeah. You had felt that the A rating that someone else had mentioned earlier, Ms. Schaefer, that should be lowered to like a triple B minus.
Yeah.
So getting back to that same kind of consistency with working with the federal government and how we rely on their expertise in some areas where we may not necessarily have it, like with eagle dangers and things like that. Are you familiar with the fact that our coal mine reclamation requirements require A ratings for this type of assurances?
I was not familiar with that.
And then you're probably also unfamiliar with the fact that that is a OSM, Office of Surface Mining, requirement that it be an A rating to make sure that if we do go to that route with financial assurances, it is in fact with a strong company providing the assurance?
No, I was not familiar with that either. This is an area where I heard from several different wind companies that, again, we are looking for some flexibility here, and I defer, again, to the individual companies about what financial mechanisms are the most viable. But, again, included this in our comments because I had heard back from several companies that this would be difficult for a lot of companies in the renewable space to meet.
Okay. Again, just shooting at you because you're the generic guy.
I'm happy to do it, Commissioner.
Okay, I have no other questions. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Well, just one follow-up to that, and maybe just to kind of better understand where we're at in the process. Will we be hearing from the other specific companies on that issue with some suggestions and to better understand why the A rating isn't workable? Are there more to come on that issue?
We heard from Mr. Costanza with Tradewind, but I believe we will be hearing from more. They're in the room, and I'm sure that there are more individual companies coming here.
All right. Very good. Thank you. I don't have any other follow-up for Chris. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate your participation and your good comments.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Hsu?
Mr. Kungle, you have broader knowledge across multiple states with laws and regulations. Would you be able to speak to any of those, just generically?
Yeah, just as far as decommissioning?
Yeah.
So, again, I think a lot of states look at this on a more local level.
Sure.
So I believe, South Dakota, and I have it pulled up on my computer, but I didn't print it out. So the South Dakota PUC has issued a model ordinance for local governments to consider, and their decommissioning, I'll have to follow up with you on this, but their decommissioning requirements are certainly a little bit different than what's proposed in here in terms of what they require up front and a couple other areas. Iowa, local, different local zoning authorities are issuing them. And oddly enough, Minnesota right now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, just announced a work group on looking at solar and wind decommissioning. And so I think a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, there's going to end up being overlap over in Minnesota. As it stands right now, the decommissioning plan is something that the PUC over there considers. But I think it could be updated, frankly. So
specifically, there are states that require financial assurances prior to construction right now, currently.
I'd have to double check, but
they are out there.
Yeah, and I think Wisconsin at least provides some proof of financial responsibility. I'm not sure if it's total. Yeah.
And with regard to salvage value, I mean, there are a lot of other states that have laws and regulations that require some sort of financial security without salvage value included as well, right?
That's a great question. I don't know off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Commissioner Christman. My name's Julie Volk. I'm with NextEra Energy Resources, and I'm here this morning to comment on the proposed rulemaking. Before I get started, I just want to know if you need a spelling of my name for the record or my company. Okay. NextEra has already filed written comments in this case. You've already heard from a number of folks this morning. I'm just going to point out a couple of things that we commented on, and then I'll be available to answer questions. Our comments address a number of areas, and I'd like to thank you, Commissioner Christman, for allowing some potential discussion on both cases being considered this morning so that we could just come up here one time. The topics that we hit on in our comments are the abandonment and useful life, decommissioning requirements, the decommissioning plan, financial assurance, and then going back over to the other case, we also address the facility siting and the technologies associated with control of lights. And rather than me walking through these, since you have my written comments, I'd be happy to answer questions. I would also like to note that there may be some specific questions that we have experts that aren't here today, that since there's an opportunity to follow up with further written comments, if I'm not able to specifically answer your questions, I do have legal counsel here with me that's taking notes, and we'll get back to you if you have any questions that I'm personally not able to address today. And I'm now ready for questions.
I thought you would go on longer. I thought I had more time to develop them. One of them that jumped out at me in the written comments that were sent out, and I assume this is a copy of the same thing, correct?
Yes, Mr. Christman, the comments that I handed out this morning, I wanted to make sure, since we submitted them a little bit late on Friday, I wanted to make sure you had a written copy available for you today. So it's exactly the same thing as we submitted.
You expressed a concern that has not been discussed here so far this morning about requirement for landowner approval of, or for commission approval of landowner requests to leave something in place. Would you not agree that, and I hate to keep referencing it, but it's been a very successful program that is very popular, I think, with the people in North Dakota. I'm referring to our mine reclamation plans. But just as we would not allow someone who has their property mined to take the cash, which the cost of reclaiming that land after mining would be far in excess of the value of the land. We, nor OSM, would allow that landowner to take a cash settlement and leave that land unreclaimed. And this at least allows the option. But wouldn't you agree that it's important that people not be able to maybe take advantage of folks who would be willing to accept a less than successful reclamation project for a cash settlement that would save the company reclamation costs but really leave land scarred unnecessarily?
Commissioner Christman, I understand the question, and really the intent of our comments was if there may be aspects of the facility that the landowner would like to retain, for example, there may be roads that the landowner would like to retain, would like to have that option. Also, some landowners may just not want to have the disruption to their land with the taking out of underground facilities, and so we want to allow that option. And that was the point of the comments that we made.
And I think that that's why, rather than, like with the mines, just requiring a full reclamation, why we left that in, because certainly from my ag background, I can certainly see situations out there where the new road is a pretty substantial improvement for an operator, and I would expect that we would want to allow those situations. And yet at the same time, if it's just a road for no road to nowhere on a hillside that's in a few years just going to be a big erosion problem, we not ought to be kind of coercing people with cash settlements to avoid reclamation costs on those. So that's why I thought it's important to have the commission approval on these things. Commissioner Fedorchak, did you have any questions for Julie?
I do. Julie, thanks for being there. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the financial assurances piece and the A rating requirement, and if your company has any concerns about that, and just provide some insight on that issue.
Good morning, Commissioner Fedorchak. I can offer some commentary there. Our written comments do address the financial assurance, and one of the points that we made there was that the requirement should refer to investment grade rather than a specific rating, whether that be A, A minus, triple B. We've had a lot of folks speak to that this morning, but it should be what's considered investment grade by that particular rating agency. And we felt that that would be a better way to address that issue than requiring a specific rating that may be determined to be a different level based on the rating agency that's offering that rating.
Don't we say investment grade already in there? I mean, what does investment grade mean, I guess, that provides the assurances we're looking for?
Commissioner Fedorchak, to the extent that it says investment grade already, I think we agree.
I'm going to jump in here, and I'm not looking at that section right in front of me, but I do not believe it says investment grade. The rule proposal says an A rating or better, similar to, as I discussed with Mr. Kunkel, what is required by both the state of North Dakota and OSM for mine reclamation. Julia, are you... Julie Volk, are you familiar with the bond rating guidelines? This was a question I was going to get to anyway, so I think this is a good time for it.
Commissioner Christman, I am not familiar with the specifics. I am generally familiar that there's ratings out there. There's investment grade and less than investment grade. So I'm not going to be able to answer specific questions on the various levels.
I'll throw something out that I learned when I was on a different legislative committee one time, and you can just tell me if you think it doesn't sound right to you. I had a hard time at that time getting over the hurdle that a B wasn't quite good, because when I was in school, I always emphasized that C is about that broad section, you know, and that my folks ought to consider that just fine. But as I recall, with Standard & Poor's or Moody's, there are about maybe 20 different bond ratings, as I recall, somewhere in there, and that the investment grades are half or probably less than half of that, and the ratings that your written testimony request be acceptable, while yes, they do fall into the investment grade category, but out of around 20 different rating options, they would really be one step higher than what is considered junk bond status. Does that sound right?
Commissioner Christman, I understand what you're saying. However, I do not have the professional expertise to comment on the rating. If you would like NextEra to go back and take a further look at this, and I would have our financial professionals take further look at this, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. And as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the hearing, this is open for comment through March 9th. Okay, Commissioner Fedorchak, did you have other questions?
No, I just am needing more information on why investment grade would provide the protections we're looking for. So hopefully NextEra can provide that in their follow-up.
Okay. And then I have one more.
Randy, on that same issue. So I don't have your written comments with me right now, but Julie, can you provide some insight as to why the B or the A rating is unworkable?
Commissioner Fedorchak, when I was working with my colleagues at NextEra, the discussion was that investment grade should be acceptable, and we did not get into the various levels of investment grade that have been discussed here this morning. So I don't have the ability to answer that specific question here. What I can do is go back and take these questions to the financial professionals, and since there is additional time to provide some written comments, we would be happy to take a look at that and provide some additional commentary in this case.
Okay, and then I have heard from some companies in the last month or so kind of an in-depth explanation as to how the projects are financed. More formally.
You have to start that over, Julie. It cut out after you heard some comments about how projects are financed. Sorry.
The street, and I guess that's going to get some formal information through this process from the companies on that issue. So if NextEra has any information like that, that would be helpful.
You were cutting in and out. I'm looking at Julie that's here, and did you understand that? I think basically, Commissioner Fedorchak, what you were saying is a request that NextEra, as well as other companies, if they choose to, provide more information about the concerns and financial assurances.
Yeah, and, I had a meeting, I can't remember with who, that said, this is just an irrelevant requirement, and they gave me kind of an exhaustive explanation as to why and how these are financed and why this isn't needed to provide the protections, and so we need that. That's the kind of in-depth info we need to fully analyze, I think, the value of adding this requirement.
Good. This time you came through clearly, but I think I just cut off Julie.
Commissioner Chrisman and Commissioner Fedorchuk, what I understand is that from the questions is that the commission would like some additional information on project finance and project finance for wind projects and how financial assurance plays into that. Is that the information you're looking for more information on?
Yes, that would be great.
In that case, I will take that back to my colleagues, and we will look to provide additional written comments in time of the March 9th deadline for this case.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and then I have one more question. In the earlier part of your testimony, you expressed concern about the rebuttable presumption that if a facility is operating at less than 10% capacity, it's probably at the end of its useful life. And I just want to use some of your own words on you. So I'm skipping ahead. In another area, when you're talking about the requirement for a decommissioning plan in advance of construction, it mentions that it could cause an indefinite amount of time, which could introduce significant delays in the siting process. Isn't that indefinite amount of delays a good reason why there should be a minimum production, albeit rebuttable, if there is a good reason, that would deem a facility at the end of its useful life so that we don't just always hear that, yes, we're going to get this going, but it's just a few more months away?
Commissioner Chrisman, I'm going to just see if I understand the question that you're asking me. With respect to abandonment or useful life, I think the concern that we have is that the availability the capacity factor is not really a good assessment. And you heard from another company this morning, Mr. Frank Costanza from Tradewinds, explained some of the reasons that are out there. And we have those same concerns. There may be things on the transmission system that aren't related to our facilities that prevent us from operating. And I will assure you that based on the financial situation, we have every motivation to make sure that the wind facility does operate. So what we'd like to do is have some further discussion about the criteria for what determines the useful life. We suggested as some alternatives in our commentary that perhaps no operation for a period of time, such as 12 months, would be a better substitute. And then if we still run into issues that we can't resolve in that time period, then we would work with the commission on that. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you were asking me, but I think that was part of the question. So if that didn't answer your question, if you want to follow up, please do.
Well, the other part of it was, and if it's no production, isn't that just going to cause, once a facility is no longer going to be used, but if someone is facing millions of dollars in reclamation costs, this indefinite dragging out, you can always trickle a little power out someplace and get by with another year without having to undertake decommissioning. I mean, it's certainly always going to be possible to get a little more power out of a wind turbine someplace and just drag it on almost forever.
Commissioner Chrisman, that's certainly not the intent. Since we do have some time to go back and think about that, we can take that into consideration. But the greater concern is really being part of the transmission system or things like the transformer that was talked about before. The lead time in the industry, if you're putting out under the grid, if one of those fails, can be numerous months, sometimes over a year. Certainly, we don't want to be in that position, but we have some concerns about that. So that's not our intention at all, and we don't want to be put in a position where we are prematurely being put into a decommissioning project when the project is expected to move forward. We have a operational issue perhaps off-site, or perhaps we're in the process of, you know, upgrading the system to newer technology on individual wind farms. We just envision that there are a number of circumstances, so we just don't think capacity factor is the right measure, and we'd like to have some further discussion about that.
Thank you. One more time, Commissioner Fedorchak?
No, I think Julie's covered my questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jay Doan. I'm a fifth-generation rancher who came back to North Dakota after working in corporate America for a Fortune 500 company in Arizona, California, and Texas. I've seen the hundreds of thousands of wind towers littered throughout those states. The beauty of this state, the open prairies and lifestyle, is important to me and my family. Wind production is changing the look of our state. There are several points that I feel are very important when considering wind as energy. Wind development has been going too fast in the state with little or no restrictions. Some wind farms get started and then are abandoned. There needs to be guidelines that identify when such a wind production has been abandoned. When it is abandoned, it's very important to the landowner that all the equipment be removed from the site. Currently, foundations are to be removed to a depth of 3 feet. This is not deep enough for us as landowners wanting to put up fences, water lines, buildings, and such, as the strength is not adequate at this depth. It would be best to require complete removal of all the concrete to ensure optimum future use of the land. I also feel it's important for wind companies to bond before any construction on these projects start, as some may get started and then quit, and the landowner is left with the cost of material removal. We need to have a bond in place prior to starting so the cost is covered. Landowners cannot afford to cover these costs, especially young farmers and ranchers like myself. I am in favor of the proposal set forth today, with the exception of the removing all of the material off the land. The state does need to get a handle on wind energy before we are completely overrun by wind towers and the beauty of our airspace is gone and wildlife has vanished. Guests do come to our state because of the beauty. Tourism and agritourism is very important to me. Some of my guests have told me that they will not return to our state if everywhere they look are blinking red lights at night and big wind towers. This is not how our state is advertised. I thank you for your time.
And Jay, beyond ranching, you do run a operation where you have guests coming in and where you would be familiar with the comments that outside guests make, right, when they come visit our state. Is that correct?
That's correct. We hosted all 50 states and over 30 foreign countries.
Regarding, I'll tell you where my heart came from on the 3 feet to 4 feet thing with the concrete. And I appreciate another rancher here to confirm or correct me. At 3 feet, is it, if someday someone needs to put fencing in there and needs to put a corner in, at 3 feet, does it really allow you to put a corner in that's going to hold and stay straight?
Mr. Chairman, I'd say not. I mean, we use augers that dig down, and if we're hitting that concrete, it's one, it's going to damage our auger, and two, the strength. I mean, we have at times some wild cattle that get out, so we want to make sure that our corner posts, our H posts, are strong enough.
And typically in the industry, that's probably around 4 feet, right?
Right.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak, do you have any questions for Jay?
Yeah, I do. Jason, thank you for taking time to be there today. It's really helpful for us to get perspectives from the industry and the landowners as well. So really appreciate you taking your time. I'm wondering, so is there a depth between 4 feet and all the concrete that you can imagine being more acceptable to you? You know, so, you know, I don't know how far down the concrete goes, but it's pretty deep. And is there a level at which that you can imagine not it interfering in the future with your likely operations? 5 feet, 8 feet, 10, what, is there some distance like that?
Commissioner Fedorchak, in my mind, I guess I couldn't come up with a depth. You know, me personally, I would say none. You know, get rid of it all. You know, one that I'd be happy with, because I don't know if we're going to be drilling, you know, water lines for our cattle, and so you do need to sometimes, you know, go down deep, so I mean, if it were up to me, I would be happy with get rid of it all the way it was. So I'm sorry. I guess I can't come up with a value.
There's so all or so we've got 4 feet in this rule, and you would say the only other alternative that you'd find acceptable would be all of it.
Yes. I mean, me personally, yes. I'd rather it be gone, because I just don't know the foreseen future. Mm-hmm. And so it's I don't want to run into that problem down the road. And I know that there's lobbyists and speakers that like to defer questions, but I would like to know, you know, how far down their foundations are. I don't know if we've established that.
Well, we hear that in our hearings, but I can't quote you right now either. So maybe somebody in that one of the next industry folks can speak to that issue, and might also shed some light on the various depths at which the concrete goes. And I think they spread out at a certain level and go wider. And so we just maybe a little more technical information on that would be helpful to fully evaluate that issue. And okay, then what about the rest of the rules? Do you think we're covering most of the concerns? Are we missing any big issues with this rule? Not that we'd add it to this rulemaking, but just for the future issues that you have concerns about.
Commissioner Fedorchak, I mean, for these specific cases, I do believe that we are covering them as a whole. Like I said, when I guess I can't speak to those at this time. It's what I've seen when I was living in Arizona and Texas, and seeing these productions down there. It's literally littering the landscape, and that's what I don't want to see for North Dakota. Just if we can pull back the reins a bit, look at other options, and I don't know. You know what they've truly, I guess, done the research on. But if I were to speak my opinion right now, which I know we're not, you've kind of opened that up for me. I would much rather put these on, you know, maybe the ocean, get them away from the prairies, and you know, maybe some water turbines or whatnot. It's places like that you know, we don't have to look at, especially live in. None of us live in the ocean, but I just know that it's not a great sight when you see, you know, hundreds of these scattered throughout the land. So that's what I'm trying to protect, that I want to protect for our family, being fifth generation. You know, working on the sixth, I have a six-month-old that kept me up all night. So I apologize if I am stumbling a bit. It's I didn't get much sleep, but so...
I could appreciate that. I'm past those 6 month old days myself, thank goodness, but they are precious. So
right.
Even without sleep, they're still precious. One follow-up question on the lighting. Can you speak to the value that you see in requiring the, it sounds like you see value in requiring the lighting detection systems that are off most of the time and kind of protect the night sky. Can you speak to that as a landowner and a rancher and somebody living out there? Why is that important?
Absolutely. You know, when we do have guests, and even me personally being out there, you know, our night sky is beautiful. That's some of the great things about coming to North Dakota, and our guests that come out, and I speak to that because we kind of take for granted a lot of times the great nature and beauty of our state, but the outside guests that come in, they fly right into Bismarck. We're 20 minutes from Bismarck, from the Bismarck Airport, and they say, "Wow, you know, there's nothing out here." And I said, "Yeah, I know. You know, we're trying to, you know, do some economic development in rural communities." They say, "No, this is great. We absolutely love the fact that we can't see anything, or we can see for miles and not see a thing, except for maybe a grain elevator in the next town over." And the fact that they love the wind as well. They actually do care for that wind rustling through the big cottonwood trees. But the fact that they don't see these big industrial units, buildings, and such scattered throughout the land, I mean, that's what's important to them. And even at night, if they were to see these blinking red lights that they don't see now, I think, you know, they might not come back to North Dakota, and that's what I don't want. Now, the lighting, you know, is important, so if they can shut these lights off, if that's, you know, the best-case scenario, them shutting them off until, you know, an aircraft comes around, so be it. That's a step in the right direction, I guess. But I know specifically that for my family and the guests that we have out there, they would rather see the northern lights or the stars at night and not be distracted by those blinking lights.
And it sounds like you have concerns generally about wind development, but just speaking as you know, we're always trying to find the balance of, you know, mitigating the impacts and trying to allow for development. How far does the lighting system that shuts off at night and eliminates that the blinking red lights, how far does that go to help ease some of your biggest concerns about wind development?
Commissioner Fedorchuk, if I'm understanding you correctly, if I were to rate the lighting issue, is that what you're speaking on?
Right.
Yep. And I do apologize. I'm all for, you know, cleaner energy and development. I just, when it's in your backyard, it really, you know, it really hits a personal level. And you wouldn't put these right smack dab right next to the Capitol because they double the size of this Capitol in height. So I guess the lights and the building structure is similar in my mind. I mean, because you're either going to see them at day, and now, you know, at night, thinking that they're hidden in darkness, well, you're gonna see them at night as well. So I mean, it's extremely important if they can, you know, utilize, you know, these systems, these, is it LID?
There's two of them. There's LIDs and I forgot
right.
The other one already.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I would stress the importance of bringing on these new technologies to help alleviate that type of light pollution. So I hope I hope.
Yep. That's good. Well, thank you, Jason. Again, appreciate your time.
And Commissioner Fedorchuk, this is Jay, J-A-Y.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jay. I heard Jason.
That's okay. We're a bunch of Jays in my family. That goes back four generations, so it's easy to confuse us all. But my dad, Jerry, will probably be getting up and speaking as well. So
he's may have been called worse things. Two things, and I don't know if any other company people are planning to testify, so I'm just going to throw something out to kind of help answer the question. I'm not sure of the answer either, so if I'm way wrong, I'm sure someone will jump up and correct it. When you're talking about the thickness of the concrete, whether they dig down further and put it 4 feet down or 3 feet down or 5 feet, whatever, I think on one that I recall that we looked at was about a 7 foot thickness, and so that is what is down there. And if I'm way wrong on that, then I expect someone will correct me, and if not, it can kind of stand, but somewhere in that ballpark. I kind of threw what I thought was a softball, but you were too modest. But I just want to clarify that it's not just a handful of folks that you run into once in a while, like we all do from other places, but your ranching operation has won both state and national conservation awards. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And agritourism is a big part of the operation, right? And that you are actually doing that and seeking and attracting people in for hunting and other tourism-related projects. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. So if I might add,
absolutely,
Commissioner Christman, I'm very passionate when it comes to agriculture, the succession, multi-generational. You know, I see younger farmers and ranchers moving away, living moving off the ranch, or it's becoming harder and harder to come back to the operation. So if we're going to throw another curveball or wrench into the situation and now not allow them to come back because of some of this development, and I'll echo the words that Mr. Buntrock had said earlier with his family, it's a very big concern. I don't want to lose them. They're neighbors of ours. When I say neighbors, they're 7 miles away, but they're neighbors. And so I don't want to see the younger generation coming back and or not coming back. And I'll just quick throw these quotes or these figures out because I do think it's important. In the last ag sense, since from 2007 to 2012, we've lost over 7 million acres in agriculture. Over 95 farms or ranches, my figures I think are wrong right now. But anyway, the average age of a farmer is 58.3, which is a continuing 30-year trend of increase. And we're at a 20% decrease in beginning farmers. So that's essentially what I want to say. Yes, we've won all these awards. And to further that, U.S. News and Travel did rank us as one of the top event and wedding destinations worldwide when you're working on a budget. So what you get, and they look at all things as far as a package. They come into the, when guests come and they want to have an event or a wedding at our ranch, they look at the beauty of North Dakota, what we offer, the historical value as well, being fifth generational. And that's really what sets us apart. North Dakota's never been selected on all three of those categories or awards that you had mentioned. And we were lucky and honored enough to receive those. And that's what we want to continue on. So I don't mean to get off subject here, but I do think it's important as a rancher and being involved in agritourism personally. So thank you.
I appreciate it. I think your perspective is important in emphasizing the importance of this effort to well, I know you're not necessarily a fan of the new generation in general, but when it does occur, of at least minimizing the impacts and making sure that they're cleaned up. So thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Shu, did you have any? Okay. Thanks. Another one that starts with a J.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Fedorchuk, you'll get tired of the Doan family here, but I wasn't really planning to follow Jay, but I've got some prepared statements here, and I usually don't read things, but I think it's important. And I will speak to the issue at hand, but also a little bit bigger picture, as Jay did, because I think it's really important for the state of North Dakota to take a hard look at this, and you as Public Service Commission as well. But my name is Jerry Doan, for the record, and I'm from McKenzie, North Dakota. And as Jay said, my family's ranched in southern Burley County since before North Dakota was a state. My great-grandfather came down out of Canada in 1882 and homesteaded there and lived in a sod house for a number of years. My family has a lot of pride in agriculture, and we work hard to improve the natural resources, including wildlife. We've been fortunate, and you talked about it, Commissioner, to win the inaugural Aldo Leopold Award for Conservation in North Dakota, and we were just named the National Environmental Stewardship Award for the nation for improving our cropland, rangeland, and wildlife resources to better protect our environment. Besides our long history in agriculture, we also operate Rolling Plains Adventure, a nationally acclaimed hunting outfitting business that has been on most of the national movies, and you might have seen them on many of those shows, and is nationally acclaimed, as well as winning the Governor's Award for the Best Tourism Package in North Dakota, I might add. And we also operate, as Jay talked about, an agritourism operation on the ranch that has brought people, as Jay mentioned, from 30 foreign countries in all 50 states. And yes, we do have a lot of conversations and a lot of interaction with lots of folks around the world about what North Dakota is and the importance of our state. Because of these ventures and our working with thousands of people visiting a ranch through many different events, we realize how extremely important our vast open country and natural resources are to our livelihood. We are not opposed to wind electrical generation. However, we are very concerned with the lack of a state plan to site wind farms in the least impacted areas. It is imperative to develop long-term plans so we don't ruin our strong economic driver, the tourism industry. It is also imperative to have a plan so we don't cause severe degradation of our wildlife assets. We continue to lose native rangeland in the state of North Dakota at an alarming rate, and we must be concerned that we don't overly impact grassland wildlife, as I'm seeing on some of the wind farms. One of the proposed wind farms right now is in the Whooping Crane Flyway. The nests are there. It will be a huge impact on those whooping cranes if we're not careful about what we're doing. The hunting industry is also a huge economic driver for North Dakota. The last point would be to protect our state beauty for the next generation. If we place wind towers that are twice as tall as the North Dakota Capitol that we're in here today on our tallest hills, which is where a lot of them are being proposed, we will ruin our landscape. We must develop long-term plans to protect our state and site wind farms where they will impact our state the very least. I feel very strong that wind companies need to have the top-rated bonding. A-rated bond or higher, like other sources of energy, I don't see the fairness in that at all. We must ensure that wind companies are held accountable for our North Dakota interests. This is very important, as out-of-the-country wind farms now working in North Dakota have stated publicly they have no intention of operating many of these wind farms. And I realize that's not all of you, but I do know specifically of a couple, so I'm relating to that. Only breaking ground to collect wind credits and move on. These bonds must be done up front at the onset to protect the landowners. I also feel very strong about wind companies having a very thorough decommissioning plan. This plan must require them to remove all concrete and other material. If not, the land value has diminished. It will be hard, if not impossible, to build, do fencing, put in a well, water pipelines, etc. We have a lot of experience with many wells on our ranch and miles of pipeline and fencing. We know if concrete is left at only the 3 feet level underground, it would make most of these projects impossible. That would mean the land value has been compromised. We must protect the value and property for the next generation. These companies have a history of selling quickly, so having insurance that the land and landowners protected is very critical. And to respond to your questions, both Julie and Randy, on the depth, we've put in a lot of water pipelines across our land because we intensive graze our pastures. That's one of the reasons we've been nationally awarded. And let's face it, these rules to drop to 3 or 4 feet probably work in most of the country, but we live in the northern plains in North Dakota. We've got to drop water lines 8 feet deep. If we have concrete at four, you can't run a water line across there anymore. And I realize, and Commissioner, you talked about reclamation in the coal fields and having it turned back to normal. And if we allow somebody to get rewarded and not take the and not be decommissioned, what happens then when that land gets sold to somebody else and there will be no dollar value to take care of taking that concrete or whatever's left under the ground? And so then the land use has changed. We can't put it to good use. I think the only right way to do that is take it back to the way it was before the wind towers came in. It is also important to have strong language to determine when the wind farm is abandoned. It is far too easy to make it appear the wind farm is in operation and avoid any decommissioning plan. This type of protection is crucial so the wind company is not taking advantage of us North Dakota landowners. I am also concerned with improving the setbacks for non-participating landowners. It was talked about a little bit this morning. I know this is a little off, but I think it's important as a state that we get a bit of a plan. If wind towers are next to your land, the realtors I have visited with tell me your land values will fall. They have shown me numbers to back that up on specific cases. Setbacks need to increase to help with that problem. We must use common sense to not let one landowner's property rights to allow wind towers overshadow another landowner's rights to have his beauty, silence, and wide open spaces in this state. In closing, I challenge the North Dakota Public Service Commission to develop regulation and a long-term vision for North Dakota wind energy that protects our beautiful state and our agriculture, tourism, and wildlife industries. I encourage you to require wind to be developed responsibly with proper landowner protection and site them in the least impacted areas. Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and again, our family's been here since 1882. We have a strong belief in North Dakota. We love this country. But the folks that come, I've sat down with people from New York that have visited our ranch and tourism, and I said, if you took, there's a proposed wind farm south of us that will change the view from Bismarck forever, the view of the Missouri River will not be the same. If those hills were covered with wind towers, would you come back here? And the answer on every one of those people I've asked is no, probably not. We go to North Dakota for the wide open spaces, for the beauty. Those of us that have lived here for generations are not opposed to wind energy, but it has to be developed responsibly and not ruin the state in the process. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd try to answer them.
Well, for myself, I gave most of my questions to Jay already, but I did think of another one, and it just occurs to me as you talk about the generational aspect of Absolutely. Property in North Dakota and changing times. Those first three generations, do you think they ever contemplated that there would be a time when you and Jay's generation would be laying water lines just out for pastures and things like that, and thus, do you think it's very reasonable to think that we can contemplate all the things that might be coming up for that sixth generation that they want to do out there when we think about leaving big pieces of concrete, or if we don't have strong decommissioning rules, turbines themselves across the countryside?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you bring up a great point. My oldest boy, Jeremy, says it best. He always says, and he was interviewed on national TV after we won the National Environmental Stewardship Award, and they asked him, and he said, we don't have a clue where we will go in agriculture. We haven't even dreamed of things that probably will happen as far as our state in agriculture, and I think that goes right to your point. So when you have big chunks of concrete or any other things buried there and somebody else takes over that land or this next generation takes it over, it changes all that. And I think we really have to get back to, if you're going to have a wind farm, then decommission back to the way the land was. I will also submit testimony from my youngest son, who just graduated at Montana State. I'm very fortunate, and probably the real exception of the rule, that I have four kids and they all came back. Most of them were in corporate jobs, all went off around the country for college degrees, but came back to North Dakota to be involved in our ranching operation. And then we have some other niches with the hunting and the tourism. I'm very proud of that. But they're very passionate about the beauty of this state and that we protect it. And Jace, he's in Arizona today, and so he submitted written testimony as well because we're concerned with that. But you bring up a great point. We don't have a clue where agriculture will be, and we have to make sure we protect that. So one other point I might make, I think the lighting issue, and that's been talked about, I think that's a step in the right direction. My family's also three generations of pilots. And the problem is where they're, and I'll reference the Burley Wind Farm again, that's going to forever change the view from Bismarck and the Missouri River. That is in the flight pattern. If you have radar on those lights, they're going to be on all the time because there's flights all over. And for us as pilots, wind towers all over where you're trying to fly gets to be a serious problem at times. So, you know, there are many issues with these things, and I have a lot of concerns. Again, I am not anti-wind at all, but we have to have a plan as a state to site them where the least impact happens.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Yeah, I'm glad you just mentioned that again, Jerry, and thanks for being there. And now that as soon as your son said, or Randy, that there was going to be a Jerry speaking up, then I was like, oh, this must be the don't. It all started to make sense to me. thank you for being there and sharing some really good thoughts with us. Can you help me understand what you mean? You've mentioned it a couple times, but what do you mean by citing them in the least impacted places, citing wind facilities in the least impacted places? What do you have in mind when it comes to that?
Sure, Commissioner Fedorchak. I think there's areas, first off, I'm really concerned about our grasslands. And a lot of them lately have been proposed to be sited on grasslands. We have a serious issue with grassland birds in the state of North Dakota, and many of these birds are on the endangered species list. Fortunately, on our ranch, we've done a lot to protect a lot of birds, and we have tremendous wildlife populations. So that's one issue. The second is, you know, and I get it for higher wind, but let's sight them on the top of the hills. Now, if you're in California, and I've spent some time there, and I look at wind farms, and yeah, you see them, but they have trees and they have mountains that cover, and so you don't see them for 100 miles. This wind farm that's proposed in southern Burley County, you will see for at least 100 miles, maybe 150. On the highest hill on our ranch, I can see the wind farm north of Baldwin, and I see those wind blinky lights every night, and I don't like that now. So least impact to me is, and I know there are landowners that want these, and I get that. But I think the better place is in cropland that is not on the top of the highest hills, less wildlife impacted. I've spent a fair amount of time with the Game and Fish and the Audubon Society and Ducks Unlimited and all them. They have a plan of where the highest impact for wildlife is in the North Dakota. I don't think we get that information out very well. And so I think a map of some of those things, and some of us are tourist areas. You know, we are very involved in tourism. That will make a huge impact. It's why my kids came back. It will take their livelihood away. I just think we really have to be concerned are where are the proper places to site in the state that have the least impact on tourism, the least impact on wildlife, and the least impact on the beauty of our state. It's been mentioned three or four times, and you realize this. They're over twice as tall as the state capitol, and I think it was Jay that mentioned we wouldn't put one next to the state capitol. That would ruin the beauty of this building. Well, we have to think in the same terms on the state of North Dakota.
Okay, so you're kind of envisioning statewide regulations that basically prohibit them from being in certain places.
Well, I think we have to go down that path. Again, I know you don't have control over all of this, Julie, but obviously I think we need a state plan of how we develop wind energy that makes sense, protects the landowners, protects our beauty, protects our industries, and yet allows some of that energy to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, the legislature is contemplating a lot of these issues. I know you're following that as well.
Right.
And trying to think through it. And it is a balance that we're very mindful of, and it's been our charge as the commission to minimize the impact and to think through all of those things. And you know, you at all of our hearings, there's the landowners who speak up and say, don't prevent me from developing my land the way I want to. And then you've got the others who say, but, you know, don't infringe on my rights and have the wind towers impacting my lights with my rights with their shadow flicker and noise and all this. So it is a balance, and it's competing landowner rights is what it is.
Right.
And there's people on both sides of that issue. And, you know, we had quite a conversation that the Industrial Commission did a number of years back when Wayne Svendsen proposed some setbacks from certain things. And, you know, the landowner groups and all kinds of people kind of came unglued with the idea that you were going to infringe on their rights by setting back a couple miles from certain designated spaces like Theodore Roosevelt National Park or all of that. So it's pretty sensitive subject, and it requires a lot of careful touch, because you're, you know, really treading on people's rights no matter where you go. So it all starts with these kinds of conversations, though, and having, you know, the openness and discussing setbacks and those sorts of things. So thank you for being part of the conversation.
Sure.
The one thing I did want to mention is there is a study resolution, because I share your concerns about land values, about wildlife impacts, agriculture impacts, some of these things that I don't think have been thoroughly analyzed in as it relates to wind development in North Dakota. And we have 10 years of really good experience now, and I feel like we should be stepping back and looking at what the impacts are or have been, and really have good scientific information to base that analysis on. And so there is a study that's been included in our budget bill. It got approved by the House, and now it's going over to the Senate. So I'd urge your support of that study in your legislative circles, that they choose that study and actually pursue it, because I do think it's important to shed some light on what the real impacts are in North Dakota. If any, they could be bigger or they could be less than everybody is assuming. So that's just a little a point that is kind of, it's flying under the radar right now, but it speaks to those very issues that you're concerned about, and I share those concerns.
Well, Commissioner, and I really do appreciate your comments. This, I know all this stuff isn't easy, trying to find the balance. We are following that legislation. I agree with you. The one point I would make is when it becomes landowner rights, usually that's not such as big of an issue, but when you put 500-foot towers in the air that you can see from so far, that really causes a problem for landowner rights. And I got into a discussion at one of the early meetings on this when I was challenged about landowner rights, and I said, I've spent my life fighting for landowner rights. I believe in landowner rights. That's what I do. And I get when somebody wants to put a wind tower next to me, that they should have the right and they need the money and that sort of thing. I get all that, and I appreciate that. But again, when you put a 500-foot tower up, that's a little different than, you know, turning over the ground or building some kind of a business or whatever it is, because that has now decreased my land values, and that's a proven fact. It's changed my quality of life, and also will degrade my business venture and make it unprofitable. So we have to be very concerned about that. This is a complete different issue, and I really appreciate that you guys are starting to look at this. I think, you know, maybe we were a little slow at coming to the table, but I really think in the conversations I've had with state leaders and legislators, people are starting to be concerned about this. Let's do it in a responsible way that has the least impact, and let's really try to protect our property rights and our North Dakota quality of life. I can't stress that enough. I speak to quality of life. I go around the country a lot talking about intensive grazing and building soil health, and I've started to speak a lot about quality of life because I think it's so important, and I get it because I've got four kids that challenge me every day about making this state better and improving agriculture and being successful and not doing it the way my great-grandfather did, my grandfather did, my dad did, and I did. So thanks so much, commissioners, for all your work and all your help on this.
Any other questions, Julie?
No, not for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Jerry. And Mr. Hsu has no questions either. No, he does not. I forgot to say it, but he had waved me off. So let me ask before you come up, how many more people want to testify? So probably two? Okay, go ahead. If more hands had gone up, we'd have probably taken a break, but we'll just keep going along.
My name is Wade Mills. I live in the area of the proposed wind farm. I'm one of the landowners with the proposed wind farm, and I have a contract on it. And I would like to add that that is my business venture. And by making rules and regulations that don't allow me to build that is making it so my business fails. And I think my rights should mean something too. And we've been on that, I've been on that land for five generations also. We came down from Canada in the 1860s. And it was said that there's nests of whooping cranes on the property. We're in the middle of a two-year, we're at the end of a two-year bird study. They have not found a nest for a whooping crane on the property. They have not counted a whooping crane on the property. That's just unfactual. And the study will be done at the end of next month. And you'll have the study in front of you. If there's any questions, I mean, I'm welcome to answer them.
I do. On the rules changes here, you said, I didn't write it down, but unnecessary, or basically, I can't remember what adjective you used, rules that could impact
this
your right to
rules.
Develop.
I know we're not talking about that, but a couple of people brought it up, even though that's not what was on
schedule.
That's what I'm just going to respond to.
That's what I was thinking you meant. Do you feel that these decommissioning rules are overly burdensome?
No, I do not.
What about the light controls?
I think that LED lighting is a great idea.
Okay.
I think that's something that should be implemented.
Okay. Thank you, Wade. Commissioner Fedorchak, do you have any questions for Wade?
So I missed a little bit of what were the concerns that you had about rules or issues that would be impacting you. You were speaking to maybe some of the legislative issues. Is that what it was?
Well, it was the setback issues that some of the people brought up earlier.
Setback. I see.
They basically are trying to get setback rules because they don't want to see them. And they're trying to get them far enough to where we can't build.
And Wade, where are you located?
I am right in the heart of the project. I own a half section of land south of Moffat Road, 3/4 mile.
Okay.
Right
and
in the
so
project.
You
and I live there too.
Right now, you're looking at a potential wind project.
Yes. It's the one that Jerry Doan was referring to. Just south of his place.
All right. So you have just highlighted it. The exact issue we face at every single wind sighting hearing.
Yes, and I mean, that's someone else's business, too, if they're trying to build it. I bought the land because of the wind farm proposed on it. I was one of the first people to sign up for the wind farm. My dad and I signed up for the wind farm in Valley City in 98, and we signed up. That didn't materialize, and then 9 years ago, we signed up with Burley Wind to start doing something, and we got the contracts in place a year later. So it's 8 years that contracts have been in place on this wind farm project, and it was sold to a wind farm company 2 years ago.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say, though, Wade, about the concerns that are expressed by others about the impact to, you know, the landscape, the long-term impact to the landscape, the land values, impact to wildlife, those sorts of things, and
like doing kind of a little bit of each here. Land value, okay? I used to own land in Wilton where the wind farm is currently up there. My land was valued at $261 an acre when I bought it. Today, it's worth $2,500 an acre. Wind farm's been there 17 years, roughly. Apparently, it hasn't affected it too much. Mm-hmm. Bismarck's constantly moving north towards that wind farm. And they're not seeing any issues with development north. They were not building near as fast to the east where there isn't a wind tower or a wind farm. So I don't see that as being a truthful statement as well. And when it comes to wildlife, they count the birds that may or may not die. I think the one in Wilton's seen one bald eagle that got killed in 17 years. How many bald eagles die in power lines and transmission lines that are already here throughout the state every year? Or car hits. I hit an owl and killed an owl the other day with my car. I mean, are we going to regulate cars off the road because we're killing raptors of some sort? It's just not realistic.
Although I wouldn't talk about it too much, having hit the owl. But
how much you can do about it.
All right. Thank you, Randy. I don't have any other questions for Wade.
Thank you, Wade. Wade, I'm sorry, Mr. Shu.
I just want to make sure I had your name correct. It's Wade Miller. Wade Mills, M-I-L-L-S.
Yes.
Okay. And because I'll have to be addressing these comments, the commission will come in up. And I just want to clarify that, so the decommissioning rules and the lighting rule changes, you're in support of?
You bet. You just have common sense. That's a common sense rules.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Now, please.
My name is David Shepard, Drake Lighting. The only reason I'm coming back is because Julie was not a part of my presentation before, and since we've started having more conversation about lighting, I kind of want to throw up my hat in the ring and have questions. I can answer them. One of the comments that was made earlier is that the FAA is fluid in the process up into the time of the site is built. I can actually speak to that, in that the last wind farm we did, we actually got the determinations like 2 weeks after we shipped the lights. So it's, I don't know that they would like the word fluid, but their process is slow and sometimes can take quite a while to get through because there's only eight. So you can imagine when you're one of those eight, you have a lot of work. One of the other points that was made by Jerry about the flight path, that is a restriction for ADLS, and not all wind farms can use ADLS, and it's because they're in flight patterns. Like one of the other ones that most people forget about is the military training zones. They're huge, and they can encompass a big area. So what you find with the ADLS, most people think, y'all don't know me from Adam, but the acronym, I created that acronym, so I'm pretty familiar with it. So ADLS lighting systems, they are off, but there is big time periods that they will be on. So thinking that they're just going to make the lights go away, that's not a true statement. They're, like I said earlier, I'm a pilot too, but as a one of the things that they're looking for is over this huge, vast area, they're looking for 1 square meter. So that can be very difficult to do. So what you have is a lot of false positives. And something that people don't pay attention to is like you were saying earlier, you got lights in your backyard, you see them all the time, and they don't bother you. Turn them off and then turn them on after about a month. They will start to bother you, because your light perception gets off and you have a more direct feeling when they come on at a really bright intensity. Julie, the product that we're getting approved is just one of many light mitigating solutions, and you probably should be using those words, light mitigating solution, because as these new products come along, as they start to combine those products, you definitely want to be putting it back towards the FAA, because they are aware of this issue and they are working diligently to solve it. Art, go ahead.
And Julie, just so you know, Mr. Shepard is the person that came on before you did, and has the lids, the light intensity dimming solution.
Right.
And so
okay.
what we do, Julie, is we look at visibility, and we take the visibility of the farm, which typically is a pretty large area, and we determine the visibility. And because a pilot does not need as much acquisition distance between the lights during high visibility, we lower or dim that light. So in what we're finding in Canada, where we're putting these systems in, the average time is about 85% of the time you will be at the 10% level. So it's substantially less light output than a 40-watt light bulb would do.
Wow. And then you can see it from much, you don't see it from as far away then.
Well, there's a couple of impacts that happen. Is one is you don't see it very well because air has a restrictive quality, and you can't see it very far. So when we restrict that light output, it's kind of like the way you feel when you're on the porch with the light versus a floodlight in your face. You can't ignore the floodlight, whereas the light on your porch, you kind of make it go away. So we have that impact. And then the other thing that I think is important is, and this is something that nobody really pays attention to, but since we're using visibility, as we increase the light output, the community doesn't notice it because their visibility gets worse. So as the visibility gets worse, your light output is greater, but you visually from the ground don't sense that increase in intensity. So what happens is your community is always seeing an extremely low dim light. And the reason you can see lights from 50 miles away is because of vertical beam. So the lights today have a vertical beam of 3 degrees, and it's really tight. So it's kind of a phenomenon in that standing close to the turbine has less candelas in your eyes than standing 50 kilometers away because you change the angle at which you're looking at that light. So you're getting more and more in the beam. And that's why they get brighter the further out you go.
Well, that's great information. Really excited to hear about the new technology. And is the LIDS technology also light that is directed up more? Because I've heard about systems that also work to direct the light up, and so you almost can't see it on the ground or on the ground level.
Well, what they're discussing to you is a variance in lighting equipment. So in the beginning, we had these huge beacons, and they were incandescent beacons, and they used really like a lighthouse technology is what it was. So, but the beam, the vertical beam that you would see, and I can't show you what that looks like, but the vertical beam would be 20 degrees plus and 20 degrees minus. So you covered a huge swath of light output. And in the early 70s, we came out with the xenon lighting systems, which is more like what you would have in your camera lens. That was able to tighten that beam down to only 5 degrees. So we had a minus 2 degrees and a plus 3 degrees. Now with LED lighting system, since the source is so small, we're able to get that beam to within 3 degrees. So we start off at zero and go up to 3 degrees. And that's what they're referring to, is that they have stopped the light from being downward.
Okay. And is that just when you have to have that starting at the, is that a technology that you install at the beginning, or can these existing facilities convert to that 3-degree lighting easily without a lot of trouble or expense? And that would in itself make a big difference on the existing systems.
So retrofitting, and I could kind of explain some of that. So aviation obstruction lighting is there's the 7460 standard, which is what I was asking that you refer to when you, instead of making you restricted in North Dakota, make it to where you can take on new technologies as they come out. Mm-hmm. And I would just put that completely on the FAA determination, because they're going to be, like with the LID system, first application is it won't go in the standard, the 7460 standard, but they will be applied for individually. So hopefully by August, our testing is done in Colorado, and then we can start, farms can actually implement that in their system. So lighting itself, if you have an existing farm, in some cases, you won't have to worry about, if you're trying to get the vertical beam right, in a lot of cases, you won't have to worry about it. But somewhere, if a farm is, say, over 10 years old, then they're going to have the higher vertical beam. So if they had to follow new rules with the 0 to 3 degree beam spread, then they would have to replace those lighting systems, which is not a huge expense. I mean, it is an expense, but it's not anywhere near what adding an ADLS system would be to an existing farm. So, like, if you had an existing farm, there's three categories you got to pay attention to. Is one, the lighting system may or may not be ADLS compatible. It has to be able. ADLS doesn't turn the lights off. It puts them in a standby mode because they have to come on within 10 seconds of being told to come on. So they have to have that feature in the lighting system. So you may have to upgrade the lighting. Most ADLS systems on a large farm, it would not be like putting one radar in the middle of the farm to cover this area. It would be 3, 4, maybe 5 radar systems to cover it. And when they determine the approval process for an ADLS, there are some applications that it's not allowed. Then there's some applications where it's only allowed on a portion of the farm. So there may be a portion close to mountainous areas where you don't get the 1,000 vertical feet penetration with the radar. So a pilot can actually get into the zone before the radar system can detect it. So in those cases, they would require lighting systems on that fringe of the farm.
Good. Well, thank you. Mr. Shepherd, could you leave your card for me? Because I'd like to be able to just call you and visit at length about
I'm actually going to be here technology. All week. So if you wanted to meet this all week, right. I actually have the light here, and we can actually show you what the dimming would look like. So I'll leave my card.
Good.
Any other
excellent.
Questions?
That's great. It's exciting to hear about all these new developments, and I really have been surprised by one thing in our pursuit of these technologies, and that is that the wind companies themselves haven't been very aware of them and have been not all that proactive, in my estimation, of trying to adopt this new technology. And so I really hope that the industry does get more progressive in this area, because it is one significant way to mitigate something that the public doesn't like, and it does help right. make the facilities more tolerable. So,
well, and some of the farms with the ADLS can be millions of dollars. So it's probably if you looked at like retroactively doing it, there are farms out there where the cost of putting an ADLS system would make it not profitable, and they would want to decommission it. So it's something you got to think about when you're going retroactively. It can be, a $10 million adventure just to put ADLS on. And right. the lids can be a lot less expensive, only because we use less expensive equipment to do it. And that may be something that's considered. But my biggest push is not to limit North Dakota to any one technology, but to let it grow as we are in this process of doing this. Because I've been in this my whole life, and everybody has hated me my whole life, and we are in the blinking light business, and we're actually excited about this kind of technology being allowed. So we're starting to become friends now. It's good. It's good news.
We don't hate you on our planes land yeah. safely.
I also want to say my goal, and I think Randy and I are on the same page, and this has never been to be technology specific. Our goal is to have the end result of minimizing the impact of the light. And so we want to include rules that get to that as much as possible and allow the industry to adapt to the best available systems over time. So I think we can all work together to that end, and everybody can agree that that's something we ought to be doing.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, we have one more, I guess. Another second time around.
Yeah, this is Frank Costanza. I just wanted to get up and give Commissioner Fedorchuk a chance if she had any questions. I don't know if she's had a chance to review our comments, but if you have any, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I'll sit down.
And Julie, Mr. Costanza is with Tradewind.
Right. And Frank, I think you were the one that had the kind of extensive conversation with me about the financing and how these systems are financed. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
You and Bob. So I don't need to add to the length of this time here, but if you could make sure, and I have not seen your comments, but if you could make sure that what you shared with me and how it's financed and how our rules do or don't add to the protections, the financial protections of the for decommissioning purposes, that I want to make sure that that information is captured in our knowledge base so we can use it in considering these rules.
I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you.
One last comment on the lighting. I think the retroactive application of lighting. I would note that, and it was touched on, thank you, that going retroactive for existing projects is difficult. And the reason why is, remember that these projects are built and financed, and the only revenue stream we have is the long-term power purchase agreement we sign with utilities. And there is a fixed price in those contracts. So our revenue stream is fixed. We're not a utility. We're not a regulated utility that can go back to customers and raise rates because somebody said, you need to retrofit your coal plant and put scrubbers on it. And then we can recover that over time from the ratepayers. We don't have that ability. So anything for a retroactive project for a project that's in the ground, if there's an expense and it's significant, we're talking seven figures or more, we have no place to recover that cost under the method of the PPA we've signed. So we're Tradewind, and I think other developers, we're more than willing to install these new systems. We don't have an objection to the new systems that are coming out. In fact, we like the idea of opening up to what's available. The only concern we have at the moment is for the systems that we're aware of, and LIDS is not one of them yet, the one that we're aware of, the radar detection system, there's only two suppliers that we're aware of, and we are concerned about availability of equipment so it doesn't slow down the construction of a project. We're worried about supply chain. If they're still small and growing, we need replacement parts. If they can't meet the demand of the industry, not just one project, but the industry growth, that is a concern of ours. So we just want that noted.
That's great.
Go ahead, Joy.
Frank, help me. I want to ask you a question about the industry's approach to these lighting systems and whether I have a fair assessment of that or not. But it feels to me, I mean, I've been talking about this for a couple of years to people on airplanes and at conferences and just everywhere I go if somebody's in the wind industry, and it literally took, I got an email from somebody saying, this technology you're talking about, wishing existed, exists, and they sent me the link to the FAA document approving the ADLS. So it feels to me that the industry is not being as progressive as it ought to be on this issue of lighting, and the fact that, you know, the LIDS technology is kind of here it is, this comes out new, and no, it didn't come to me from anybody in the you know, wind industry developing projects in North Dakota. So why aren't you guys more active in pursuing this and more, you know, even just the retroactively trying to apply this technology, even though, like the LIDS technology, that maybe it's not approved yet, but talking about the fact that it's out there and we want to be using this as soon as we can, that one's less expensive. So why, you know, to speak to the your company's interest in pursuing these technologies and being progressive about it?
Commissioner, the only thing I can tell you just purely from a Tradewind point of view is we as a company have only become recently aware of these systems. There are a couple of states that are in the same, probably the same timeline that North Dakota is. Michigan is one of them that are considering requiring the installation of these. But to our knowledge, our company's knowledge, we have not been approached by companies trying to sell us the best and latest technology on lighting. Shaming us, I guess, a little bit if it's been out there, but it's not, to our knowledge, it's not readily and widely available yet, and that may be the biggest reason. There just aren't a lot of suppliers of the equipment.
Okay.
Excuse me. Is
the reason you don't know is it came out, the ADLS didn't come out until December of 2015.
We can't have back and forth, really, and point taken, though. The fact that in a competitive market, and when I say a competitive market, I'm talking in regionally where distribution companies could have options of where they get their power from nuclear, from coal, from gas, from solar, from wind. The fact that you have chosen to take some risk and do real long-term contracts in order to sew something up, is that a good reason why you should be insulated from any new regulations or requirements or evolutions in state-of-the-art equipment that your competitors, who take a different business approach and prepare for the fact that times do change over the course of decades and don't offer those kinds of long-term contracts, are susceptible to?
It's a very good question, Commissioner. The principal reason the independent power business, and I'm not just talking about renewable energy, the principal reason that we have these long-term PPAs is because we have to finance these projects over a long period of time. Why? Because every one of the utilities, our customers are regulated utilities for the most part, sometimes cooperatives. Most of those utilities are regulated at state commissions, and they are driven by the commissions to secure the lowest cost power they possibly can. Lowest cost power means we have to reduce our costs in order to supply that. In order to get the cost low enough to make it attractive to them, we finance these over long periods of time to reduce the cost. It's like your home mortgage. Your mortgage would be much higher if you had a 15-year mortgage, lower if you have a 30-year mortgage. Your house will last 30 years if properly maintained. Power equipment's the same thing. So we spread the financing out, we spread the PPA out because in order to get financing that makes the price low enough to make it attractive to utilities, we also have to have a PPA. We can't get the financiers to give us that capital. If you had a, let me just give you an example. If we had a 15-year financing, the lenders, those financiers, want our PPAs to be at least 15 years, and if not, a little bit longer. And the reason for that is that's our only revenue stream. So we have to match up, in order to get the cost down, we've got to match up a PPA term to a financing term that lowers the price of energy that makes it attractive to the utilities to buy it in the first place.
So I understand that point, but would, say, a gas-fired power plant that would also be wanting to do that same thing and be able to offer long-term contracts, and then a couple of years ago, North Dakota puts on flaring requirements to minimize the amount of flaring, and the cost of producing oil and gas actually goes up. They have to absorb it. It's a reality. And so don't all industries face that?
Well, prior to being involved in the renewable energy business, I worked for a utility and I managed their independent power company. And we built gas-fired combustion turbine projects, the very thing you're pointing to. Same principle applied to those as well. We signed long-term contracts with fixed known pricing so the utilities knew what they were buying so that they could get approval at the commissions. in order, and we had long-term contracts because we had long-term financings. You also want to match your financing up to not the life of the project, but certainly you want to match it up to a long-term asset. You'd have a longer-term financing, again, to reduce the cost of the delivered energy.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak? Okay, thank you. And did you have an...
Sorry, Randy, I had my phone on mute. I didn't realize I had it on mute.
Did you have a question for Mr. Costanza?
Yes, I do. And it was kind of along the same lines of yours, but I was thinking more specifically too. So on these long-term contracts, because wind is relatively new and we think we know how long the turbines are going to last, but the reality is a lot of this technology hasn't been out there for 20 years, or we don't know that the lifespan of these turbines is going to be 20 years, 15 or 10. Something fatal could go wrong earlier. How does the industry protect itself through the PPAs for that kind of unanticipated maintenance that might be viewed similarly to, you know, a lightning system change? How do you work that flexibility in PPAs?
Good question. When we build our pro formas for our projects, one of the things that we built in the wind industry, we also build it in the gas industry, gas-fired combustion turbine industry. We look at the periodic maintenance requirements, both annual and long-term. And we build, knowing what the use cycle of that generating equipment is going to be, we build in estimated costs that we're going to incur over the life of that project. Now, we are at risk a bit for, you know, if we got into a period of hyperinflation, that could throw things out of whack. But generally, that hasn't been the case, and certainly it hasn't been the case since the early 70s. But we build those costs in. We know that we can get a wind turbine is no different than a gas turbine. If you properly maintain that generating equipment, you will get the useful life out of it that you expect, which is 20 or 30 years. And so we do build the cost of both short-term and long-term maintenance into the model, the financial model we build, which we base our long-term power rates on.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we got out of that high inflation times by everybody wearing those whip inflation now buttons, right? Mr. Shepard, did you have a comment that you wanted to add on the record? We would need you at the microphone.
This is David Shepard. I was just saying that the reason no one knows about the technologies that you're talking about in regards to the lighting, the ADLS system was, to put it bluntly, forced down the throat of the FAA. They don't particularly like it. They're nervous about it. And it's still on the fringe of what they like and what they won't accept. So that's why they treat them individually. They look at them individually. It takes a pretty long time to get one approved. I think the second one in America was just approved. So you don't know about LIDS because it's all behind the scenes, and we can't really market it to, say, trade wind right now, because I'm not able to go to the FAA and say, hey, make this a LIDS compatible lighting system, and that won't happen probably till August.
Sure, I appreciate that. But I do think that the fact that I'm finding out about them, being a lone commissioner out here in North Dakota, you had, you know, wind industry folks who were actively looking for this, they'd be able to find out about it too.
I think they're starting to look for these things now because commissioners are saying this is what we want. We want a light mitigating solution, and we have several projects in the works in Canada right now that is the reason why, is because it was part of the contract before they started the project.
All right, very good. Well, I guess we can take credit for some things, Randy.
I'll hand you the credit. We do have now one more that has a comment.
Hi. Good morning. My name is Tom Carlson, and I'm here with EDF Renewable Energy. I manage regulatory and legislative affairs for the company. And I just wanted to note for the record that we are here and really have appreciated the discussion today. I've taken lots of notes. We are members of the industry association that spoke earlier, Wind on the Wires, and just wanted to note that we did contribute to those comments as well as other members of Wind on the Wires. And again, really do appreciate the conversation. I also do want to note that I'm very, very glad that Mr. David Shepherd was here with for Drake Lighting today. We have been working with Drake Lighting and Technostrobe with on the LIDS technology, and it is going to be tested, I believe, starting in March. Coming up soon here on a project of ours in Oklahoma, tested by the FAA. So just want to know that we're actively looking at this, and, you know, as it has been said, we're very excited about the you know, advancements in technology for light mitigation.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks.
Question, Julie? Okay. Mr. Hsu? Any other comments? We've heard here from, what, two Julies and two Jerrys and a Jay and a Jean and a Jack. And but even if your name doesn't start with Jay, there's one more chance. Okay. All the comments provided through the in writing through the close of business on January 9th of 2017 will also be considered and discussed in our decision. Also, any changes made to the proposed rules due to the Commission's review of these comments received or the Commission discussion will be explained in the written decision. The record will remain open until March 9th, 2017. Thank you for your time, and we are adjourned.
Randy, one other quick question, if I might. Are you still there?
I'm going to unadjourn us, yes.
Commissioner Christman, there's one other thing we still need to address before the hearing closes as well.
Okay, so go ahead, Julie, and then Jack. I guess I've forgotten something.
I just wanted to clarify, this is more of a procedural thing, but is it possible for us, either myself or you, to talk directly to any of the folks who provided written comments and ask questions, or is that not allowed at this point? What help me understand that? I wanted to have this conversation in everybody's presence, so everybody knows what is and isn't allowed on kind of the rules procedures.
I'm going to look to Mr. Hsu to clarify how ex parte rules would apply it here.
Commissioner Fedorchak, there are no ex parte rules for the rulemaking process, so you have the opportunity to speak with any of the people who are here today or any other persons who would like to speak with you.
Okay, great. And then that's considered on the record too, or does it matter?
That would not be considered on the record unless it's written up and placed in the record.
Okay.
So it could be submitted subsequently.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. So I may follow up with some folks directly with questions after today, after I'm able to read all the written comments.
And by the way, just for members of the public, when we talk about passing rules, it's not just like out of a three-person commission, as long as two of us agree, well, we just change the rule and we're done. There are very specific laws that regulate how we do these rules, and when we ultimately do pass a set of rules, they will need approval from the Attorney General's office and from a legislative committee as well. So it is a very detailed process, and we don't do it a lot, and that's why I'm not even sure the other thing that I've missed here.
Commissioner, the other thing, it wasn't something that you missed. There was something we were supposed to testify to in PU 16775. Not in addition to the aircraft lighting system, there was also the updated 2012 to 2017 Electrical Safety Code edition. That was another modification to the rules. And I would just like Mr. Lean to take the stand again just to briefly describe that. It should just take a couple minutes.
Please do. And I think we'll proceed. It's been a pretty long time, but I think we'll proceed without taking a break because I don't think that that's a very controversial thing.
Okay, Mr. Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Jerry Land, and the purpose of this testimony is to explain and provide support for changes proposed to the administrative rules in Section 6909.0235 of the code. This section adopts the National Electric Safety Code by reference. The National Electric Safety Code is updated periodically with a new edition issued every 5 years. The changes proposed would adopt the latest NESC 2017 edition instead of the previously adopted 2012 edition. Purpose of adopting the 2017 edition is to assure that North Dakota safety requirements keep pace with industry standards. In particular, in practice, the utilities are committed to safety and are already applying the 2017 edition. This concludes my testimony. I would be happy to answer any questions.
I don't have any questions, but I know when I read through them, I like the 2017 version a lot better than the 2012 version. So, Commissioner Fedorchak, any questions?
No questions.
Okay. Mr. Hsu? Thank you, Jerry. And does anyone have any comments on this additional rule change regarding the National Electric Safety Code? Thank you. But the same holds true as what I mentioned earlier for the other proposals. The record will remain open until March 9th on this one as well of 2017. And with that, did you have any other comments before we wrap up, Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't. Thank you, Randy. And I, again, my apologies for not being there in person, but hopefully I've captured most of the conversation, even by phone, and we'll be digging in further to the written comments upon my return.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. And this time we're really adjourned.